I wonder how many of you have fallen for the old trick again. The old trick, you're believing it, you're drinking the Kool-Aid. I mean, you are in lock, stock, and barrel with this ridiculous notion that the Detroit Lions might actually be a contender. Wow. Unity Festival, cricket, cricket, cricket. I don't know. If you believe that the pieces are coming together, good for you. I can see that too. If you believe that Matt Stafford's shoulder is made of something other than Barbie doll components and China, good for you. But the truth is, I actually like the new and improved Lions. I believe that they're getting closer to being a contender. But here's the point I want to make this morning. It is difficult for a team that has not truly been a serious contender for almost 50 years, has not won a championship for 54 years, to do the things necessary to turn that corner, because you have all of these variables. You have the owners and how much money they spend or don't spend on the team, certainly that's a factor. You have the personnel that the owners hire to help them run the team, the CEO, the general manager, the coach that they hire, that's huge. The draft pick choices are then a factor, and the free agent signings are a factor. And some would like you to believe, not in Michigan anymore, but in other cities, that the stadium, that where the team plays and what the stadium is like, that that's a genuine factor. But here is the point. The mindset of the organization, the mindset after not being champion since 1957 is huge. And so you have to turn the attitude around. You have to see things differently. You have to be willing to look at the past and assess it honestly. You have to go back in a time machine and unhire Millen. You have to do all kinds. Just kidding. And of course, for those of you that are Detroit Lions fans, one of the biggest consolations is that the Chicago Cubs haven't waited 54 years. They've been waiting 103 years for a championship. So all of the bumper stickers that say we believe and this is the year and so on, they still haven't been able to turn the tide. I was amazed this year, again, Chicago Station talking about the Cubs, and they show that ragged footage of a fan catching a baseball that should have been an out, but the fan caught the ball, and they still point to that poor guy as the reason why the Cubs haven't won a championship in 103 years. Come on, people. Here's the point. Anything that goes on and on and on and on in a negative way just seems to make change more difficult. And that's why on the back of your bulletin, the title of the sermon is How to Change a 100-Year Trend. Because one of the things that oftentimes happens when we look at the Bible, you have to understand the Bible in a couple of ways. You have to understand it in its historical context. And you can't take 21st century commonalities. You can't take 21st century thinking and apply it back 3,000 years and say, people must have thought the same, people must have reacted the same. Everything's the same except a 3,000-year gap. Things were different, so you have to understand it in its historical context. And the next thing you have to do or be careful of when you read the Bible is that you don't take and think that just because one verse or one chapter leaves off here, that it is the next moment, that it's the next beat, that something else happened. The people that have been allowed to return to the area in and around Jerusalem have been there for about 100 years. And the people that went specifically to begin the process of rebuilding the temple in that devastated city, they've been there between 13 and 17 years. So there's a lot of people that are struggling with a lot of frustration, and it's not going to be easy to turn that around. And so in your Bible, if you want to turn to Nehemiah chapter 2, that's where we're going to be today. And we're going to be talking about this idea of what it means to return someplace, to revisit the past failures, to revisit what it is that's maybe hindering you today, the things that are actually taking your life and moving in a direction that you wish it would stop going today. How do you get back to the origin of that problem so that you can turn it around? Nehemiah has been told by the king that he can return, but he's returning to a city and to a group of people that have been struggling for a long, long time. And so here's the question: how do you motivate people that have been frustrated as a people group? Probably no specific individual has been there struggling for 100 years, but as a group, as a people with a mindset, how do you motivate them when there's been frustration for almost 100 years? Put yourself in that position. I mention this just as a point of reference sometimes, but here we are as a nation of people, the United States of America, been in existence as a nation for just over 230 years, 240 years going on now. That seems like forever. But in the light of human history, not only in the light of eternity, but in the light of human history, that's just a blip on the map. It's not that much. And so these people have been in really difficult circumstances for just under half of what we've been in existence as a nation. And so during that 100 years, they have been trying and failing to rebuild a city. And there have been all sorts of obstacles, everything from the resources that it takes. You know, when you're a people without a nation anymore, when you're a people without leadership and without kings and without armies, it's difficult to rebuild that city because you have all sorts of enemies. There's all sorts of things that are against you. You have the threats and the danger of the people that were delighted to see the city walls fall, maybe even participated in its destruction, and they do not want to see you rebuild. And for God's people, those broken down city walls are also a reminder of something that is very personal, and it's how they took God's plan and God's promises, basically spit on them, did their own thing, their own way, and they are where they are, some of them in exile, some of them back in the city and in the region, but in danger because they rebelled against God. And so every day when they get up and they see the state of their city and its walls, they are reminded that they didn't used to be this way. They used to be the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. They used to have the kings and the military that everybody else looked at and said, man, if we could be like them, that would be incredible. Now they're in disgrace. And they wonder if they've been completely abandoned by God or if there's a way back. Nehemiah is coming back. Artaxerxes lets Nehemiah come back, and it's a part of an evidence that God has not given up on his people. Artaxerxes agreed to let Nehemiah return to Jerusalem for 3 years to rebuild the walls and the gates. Nehemiah has a plan, but with any plan, if the plan is cooked up in this building or in this room or in this city, and you're going to see things firsthand for yourself for the first time, you have to wonder, is this really going to work after all? It's one thing to sit in the king's palace and dream about changing something, but what will happen when you're actually there, when your boots on the ground? Now, before we move on, let me challenge you to do something, because it would be a really nice, comfortable, convenient sermon this morning to talk about Nehemiah and the Jews and Jerusalem and talk about what Nehemiah saw and did that turned things around. But if you just let this be an ancient history lesson about city building or wall building, it will be of little to no value to you. The point of this is going to be, the principles are going to be applicable to things in your life, physical things, emotional things, spiritual things that are broken. Areas where you've been struggling. If you will allow God's Spirit to do this, his challenge to you will be, is there something here that I can use to make changes, to make repairs, so that my life and my circumstances are different? So, if you are going to change a 100-year trend, the first thing you're going to need to do is this, and we see this in Nehemiah's life, you're going to need to take your time. Take your time. I know from personal experience that oftentimes what happens is we will let something go in our life. We'll let it go for weeks, for months, sometimes for years. And then all of a sudden something happens, and it's a life circumstance or it's a person that comes into our life and they challenge us, and all of a sudden we find ourselves motivated to change, and we go from inactivity and from apathy to things have to change, and they have to change now. We get this frenetic energy. But sometimes I believe that what God wants us to do is when we realize that we're being confronted about something that needs repair or change, to stop, to take our time. Here's what happened with Nehemiah. Just kind of one of those verses that you go, oh, it's a real fantastic way to start a sermon. Nehemiah 2:11, I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, comma. Now, the reason I don't want us to rush over this verse is because there must be something significant. Even if we can't precisely exactly say what, there must be something significant about Nehemiah showing up at the city. And folks, he has been anticipating this for months. This has been the burden and the call on his life for months. And how do you arrive finally in Jerusalem and say, and so I took a 3-day nap, or I just laid low for 3 days? What's going on? See, if you go someplace and you lay low, people are going to look at you and say, well, don't you care? Aren't you serious? Didn't you come here to do something? Let's get going. And I'm sure that when Nehemiah arrived, there was some degree of buzz about Nehemiah and the entourage, the soldiers, and the materials and everything that Artaxerxes sent with Nehemiah. It would cause a lot of conversation. But Nehemiah said, here's what I did. I just went and I stayed there 3 days doing nothing. Now, some commentaries say he may have arrived on the eve of the Sabbath and waited to do anything because the law would not allow him to work on the eve of and the day of the Sabbath. So a spiritual reason. Some believe that he had family business to take care of and that he didn't just go somewhere and stay by himself, but he did a few personal things before digging into the task. And I'm going to call that a possible emotional reason. Some believe that it's simply that he was tired. After all, you may not realize this, but the distance from Babylon to Jerusalem was about 900 miles. And so you could only travel so many miles in a day by caravan. He's been traveling a long way. He's been traveling a long time. So a physical reason. In reality, it was probably a combination of those things, and we don't exactly know what. But here's something to think about. When you are looking at facing down a task, digging into trying to change something, are you rested and thinking clearly? That's a fair question to ask. A lot of times, our tries and fails are because we are just absolutely empty emotionally, or we are empty spiritually, or we are empty physically, or a combination of those three, and we don't have the will to fight, we don't have the will to persevere. Let God pour into you. Find rest in Him before you launch in your own strength to try to change something that needs to be changed. You know, here's the amazing thing for us humans to contemplate sometimes. But just because all of a sudden we are in a hurry does not mean that God sees things the same way. God is not nervous. God is not anxious. God is not in a hurry, and God is never late. So find your pacing in the character of God and let Him give you rest and let Him motivate you when it's time. So the first thing He did is He waited. The next thing is you have to assess the challenges that you're facing realistically. What are the challenges? Have you really thought through them? And Nehemiah does an amazing job of assessing the challenges that he's facing. Up to this point in time, remember, he had eyewitness secondhand accounts. He had his brother and his brother's friends telling him what was happening in Jerusalem and the degree of the rubble, the degree of the danger. But now he's going to assess it for himself. chapter 2, starting with verse 12. After 3 days of laying low, I set out during the night with a few others. I had not told anyone what my God had put on my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. So Nehemiah on a donkey or something, I guess, riding with just a few trusted people with him. By night, I went out through the valley gate towards the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on toward the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through, so I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or the nobles or the officials or any others who would be doing the work. Now, there's a lot there. Obviously, some markers around and in the city that probably don't make a whole lot of sense to you unless you very quickly thought, and in the back of a lot of your Bibles, there's a series of maps, and it's not uncommon for a Bible to have a map of historic Jerusalem. So you'd be able to see some of these things that he's talking about. But I don't think the point here is necessarily these locations in and around the city. The point is that for someone who had heard of the splendor of Jerusalem in its heyday, Nehemiah is coming in and he has a certain expectation of what he's going to see. And what does he see? He sees parts of the city where the destruction is so bad that one person on a donkey can't even get through an area. It's bad. There is the evidence of the amount of work that is ahead. But most important, I think, is just the way that Nehemiah goes about assessing the situation. Notice that he tells no one what he is thinking or planning. And I put it this way in your outline. When you are getting ready to tackle a challenge, please, if it's at all possible, avoid premature statements and promises. It's so easy to see a problem, a struggle, a situation, and quickly wade in and say, we're going to do this and that and the other thing, and make statements and promises that are not backed up by the facts and are not going to ultimately be backed up by your ability to accomplish what you promised. This is a lesson that we dads need to learn a lot. There's something about us dads that when something is going wrong, we step in and we promise our wife or we promise our kids, don't worry about it, I will do this and I will do that and I'll fix it. And then we find out sometimes that it's a problem that can't be fixed just by dad being a strong-willed guy. So be careful about making those promises. To share prematurely in Nehemiah's case would be to alert his enemies about what he's going to do. To share prematurely to the people inside and around the city would be to bring out all of the old failure stories, right? You step into a situation and it's been bad for a long time, and what do people do? Oh, we've tried that. We took that tack before. It didn't work. Nothing worked. Nothing will work. And you hear so much negative that it cuts the legs out from under the positive that's about to happen. Interesting thing, as we go through this series in Nehemiah, you will never, ever find Nehemiah wasting words. Now, obviously, Nehemiah said things that aren't recorded in this book. But when they record what Nehemiah said, his words are always brief and to the point and based in something very important, and that is facts. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 20 talks about saying things prematurely. Observe the people who always talk before they think. Even simpletons, even fools are better off than they. Before you say something, think it through. Do I have all the facts? Which is the next point. Don't assume anything. Know the facts. Do I know the facts well enough to make a statement? Do I know the parties that are involved in this conflict well enough to step in and take a side? I better wait. Don't assume anything. Know the facts. See, before talking to anyone about what God had led him to do, and before asking other people their opinions, their history, what they had tried and failed at, not that asking these things is necessarily bad, Nehemiah does this detailed tour of the entire city because he wants to know for himself. Not even what his brother said is good enough. He wants to know the challenges that he's facing. He wants to know what the truth is. And here's what we know. Even if you have the tour guide that tries to be as unbiased as he possibly can, any one of us who gives a tour has a bias. Any one of us who walks someone else into a situation and shows them the situation and explains it to them, we have a bias, don't we? I give a lot of tours of this building. I do. People walk in and for different reasons, they'll say, "Hey, wow, this is interesting. Didn't this used to be a bowling alley?" And they want the tour. And so I discovered a certain way that I give the tour. And there are certain things that I say every time. And they are, to me, the important things that I want someone to understand about how God brought us here and what he did to give us ministry in this place and all of that. You know, if you gave the tour, you'd give a different spiel. If you gave it, you'd probably have a somewhat different perspective. And so Nehemiah says, tour guides, they serve a purpose, but I want to see this and experience it for myself. Proverbs 19, verse 2. Enthusiasm without knowledge is no good. Haste makes a mistake. Does Nehemiah have a zeal? Does he have a passion? Does he have enthusiasm for the task that's ahead of him? Absolutely yes. Is he going to take his time to make sure that he has all the facts? Absolutely yes. And then, after you've done that, then take whatever steps are necessary to clarify your plan. So, you're not promising anything on the front end until you've dug in deeper yourself. You dig in, you don't assume anything, you get to know the facts. And then, with those facts laying in front of you, you take your time and you take the steps necessary to put them in the order that makes the most sense, the way that makes a plan that's most workable. It's one thing to hear about the destruction of Jerusalem while sitting in the king's palace in Babylon. You can formulate a plan from there, you really can. But now that he's actually in the city, he can improve that plan. He has seen the city for himself. He has seen what areas are worst. He knows what areas are most exposed to the enemies, and it helps clarify the plan. A number of years ago, not enough years ago, but a number of years ago, I had the opportunity to buy an entire house for a dollar. Now, doesn't that sound like the most amazing, foolproof offer that anybody could ever make you? I will sell you this entire house for a dollar. All you have to do is either demolish it or move it. Now, first of all, why would you buy a house for a dollar and then demolish it? That's nonsense. So I bought this house for a dollar to move it. And I had moved a house before. And so since I had done this once before, I thought I was a house moving expert. And I agreed. I gave him a dollar. I signed the contract. That house was mine. Now I had a window of time to get that house moved. And what I discovered was that there was a lot of red tape that I was not aware of. I was in a city instead of a township. There were power lines. There were street easement issues. There was the lot that I wanted to move it to. What I'm trying to say is this. If I had stopped and taken the time to clarify the plan, I might have killed the plan. But I didn't. I put a dollar down, I signed a contract, and I moved forward, and the thing just got uglier and uglier and weirder as time went on. And I've told you this before, but the skinny, the bottom line of the story is this, that on the house, I broke even, if you don't count the hundreds of hours that myself and my dad put into that house. So if you don't count our labor as being worth anything, I broke even. And was pretty happy to do that, to be honest with you. See, One of the things that you will most often realize when you take the time to look at a situation and assess it from that standpoint is you can't tackle this by yourself. You need other people's help and you need other people's insight. And so Nehemiah comes to the point where he says, okay, I've thought about it, I've seen it, I've clarified my plan, now I need to inform and involve the others. Because Nehemiah is not going to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem by himself. Absolutely impossible. But he has a plan. Verse 17. Then I said to them, the people, great and small, in and around Jerusalem, you see the trouble we are in. Please pay attention to the personal pronouns here. You see the trouble that we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. As he approaches the people, he wants them to know a couple of things. First, he wants them to know that the problem has been identified. You would think that this is obvious, and in some ways it is, but remember, these are people that have been living in these circumstances, many of them for their entire life. And that city in that condition, that much rubble, that much destruction, that's just what they know. And it's amazing how people's minds get adjusted to that. You ever walk into someone's house and not being weirdly critical or anything, you just walk in people's house and go, oh, gracious sakes. Wow. I mean, you walk into, let me put it in these terms. You're a parent, you walk into your child's room. You walk in and you say, oh, sweetheart, no, no, sweetheart, no, no. We are not going to live this way. And they look at you with all honesty and innocence and go, what? What? What are you talking about? They don't see what you see. You see the aftermath of a tornado. They see a room that they sincerely tried to straighten up when you told them to. And they're two very different pictures. You see, those stuck may not see it. Those stuck may be so used to seeing what they see and so used to feeling what they feel that you walk in and you really are, you're re-enlightening them. So you have to identify the problem for them again. But then you have to be ready with something very important. You have to be ready with a solution. What is the solution? If this is the problem, if this mess is unworkable, then what is the solution? Verse 17, Nehemiah basically summarizes it. Let's rebuild and let's remove the disgrace that is upon this city. Let's remove the disgrace that is upon us people. Because we're here because we disobeyed and rebelled against God. Now, don't rush past that simple two-pronged statement. Two significant issues that need to be addressed. One of them is physical and one of them is spiritual. Let's rebuild the walls. That's a physical problem. We're in a bad place. We're in a vulnerable and dangerous place because these walls need to be replaced. But there is a deeper issue. It is the relationship between these people and God. And it's an issue that goes back into what happened, again, that caused Israel to be defeated by its enemies and that has them in this condition today. Those broken walls scream to those people that they still haven't experienced a full restoration in their relationship with God yet. And God sending Nehemiah was his way of saying, I want things to be the way they should be. You're in disgrace, but I want you to live in grace. And so I'm going to restore your security. One other important thing, Nehemiah wants them to know, as I mentioned, that they're all in this together. It isn't me here to rescue pitiful you. It's us. We are all in this together. He identified with Israel's sin, remember in chapter 1, when he first heard about the state of Jerusalem, and he was crying before God and praying. He said, listen, I and my fathers and my forefathers have sinned against you terribly, God. He is identifying with this sin problem. And he wants them to understand that he's there not to be their boss, but to work with them on fixing it. I'm reminded of Moses being challenged that making things in the camp of the Israelites right on the Exodus was not something he could handle by himself. His father-in-law, Jethro, walks up and he sees Moses from morning to evening sitting there listening to and arbitrating the people's problems and struggles and so on. And people weren't getting justice and Moses wasn't getting any rest. And so Jethro says to him, "This is not good." Jethro is Moses' father-in-law. "You are going to wear yourself out and the people too. This job is too heavy a burden for you to handle by yourself. Now listen to me and let me give you a word of advice. And may God be with you. You should continue to be the people's representative before God, bringing their disputes to him. Teach them God's decrees and give them his instructions. Show them how to conduct their lives. But," here's the but, we have to be in this together, "but select from all the people some capable, honest men who fear God and who hate bribes, and appoint them as leaders over groups of 1,000 and of 100 and of 50 and of 10. You've got to share the responsibility. You've got to involve others. And then Nehemiah does another thing. He makes it personal. He shares his testimony of how it is that he's here. Why is he in Jerusalem talking to them right now? He says, "I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me." A testimony should not be all about you, but it should not leave you out of the equation either. A testimony might be you and what you did and what God did in response to that, or it might be how you found yourself moved from this place to the next because God is at work in a circumstance. See, if Nehemiah is just talking about himself and life in the king's court, that would be interesting but not very inspirational to these people. But when he tells them that as the king's cupbearer, he saw God move the heart and the hand of Artaxerxes to completely change his mind about whether or not Jerusalem's walls could be rebuilt, that gets the people excited. Not just why he was there, but how God did it. Because there are miracles involved, and there is provision and help and protection from the king that's involved in all of this. And when you take the time to assess the challenges and share what God has done and invite others then to join you, you should expect a reaction. And you might even get a positive one. Not all the time. You know, sometimes you'll go through all of these steps. You'll take your time. You'll really be careful in your study of the situation. You'll come up with a plan. You'll clarify the plan. You'll rely on God for his help and his grace. You'll share it with other people, and you'll get no positive response at all. But fortunately, in Nehemiah's case, there's a response, and the response is powerful. Look at this. They replied, "Let's start rebuilding." What has he told them? He said, "We are in disgrace. We need to rebuild the walls. God is with me. This is what he's done already." The people say, "Then let's go." And so they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about this, they mocked and they ridiculed us. "What is this you're doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" I answered them by saying, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it." That's a stronger statement than you would probably see at first blush. And isn't that the conflict that exists even to this day? Here are the Jewish people in Jerusalem and in the nation of Israel, and they're saying, "This is the land that God gave to us. It's really not that big. It's really not that much. But God gave it to us, and over the years, he's brought us here again and again, and he's protected us here, and it's ours. It's our birthright and our heritage from God." And the people around them saying, no. "We took that away from you. You can't have it back." That's what these people are saying, and I love Nehemiah's statement. "This is ours. God gave it to us. You have no historic right or claim to it." That jumps into the present, folks. But the Jews, they're energized. Nehemiah says, "This is what's going on. This is how God is in it." The people get energized, and the opposition intensifies. They have a plan, the opposition does, and it's worked before. Tell the king what's happening in Jerusalem, and that the people plan to challenge his authority. And in the past, the king, whether it be Artaxerxes or Nebuchadnezzar, would say, well, then they must stop. They can't have their security back. But Nehemiah is convinced that God being with him in the way he has, that he will be able to prevail against their threats. He refuses to get distracted by the opposition because he knows that God has put the king on his side, that the people are ready to work, and that the walls are going to be built. You see, we should anticipate. Now listen to this. Whatever it is, the struggle or the problem that you're thinking about in your own life, you should expect progress and opposition all at the same time. If you think that the moment you make a decision to change direction, that everything is going to be sunshine and lollipops, boy, are you going to be surprised. When even the people that you thought you were closest to say, why are you doing that? Why are you changing that? Why don't you act this way anymore? Come on, let's go back to the way things used to be. It happens all the time. Expect progress and opposition. 1 Corinthians, Paul put it this way. I will stay here in Ephesus until the day of Pentecost. There is a real opportunity here for a great and worthwhile work, even though there is a growing number of opponents. Paul got it. This great opportunity does not mean that I should expect no opposition. I said that last week. They go together. So how can we apply this to our lives? Very quickly, very simply. To change a longstanding anything, whatever it is in your life, first is this: stop excusing or justifying it. Until you call it what it is, until you call it a problem, until you say that it's ugly, until you say it's painful, that it's a broken wall, that it's a dangerous situation, and that it needs to change, you are not going to change it. You've got to admit that it's bad. You've got to admit it's a problem. Next, you've got to be realistic and strategic. You have to pick a starting time. You have to choose perhaps the thing that needs to be dealt with first. This is going to take time. You're going to have to see the big picture and then break it down into components and expect opposition and setbacks. And then last, never take God out of the equation. It will only be with his help. It will only be with his strength. It will only be by his grace that you make the changes necessary to turn around a 100-year trend. Start with God and start today. He is on your side. He desires to give you success and victory in these realms of your life. In fact, he wants to see these changes happen, to be honest, more than we do. And greater is he that is in you than he that's in the world. Father, whatever it is, as these men and women stand in your presence right now, whatever it is that they've been struggling with, that you have been talking to them in their heart about turning around or changing, I pray that they would know your encouragement and your grace and your power to begin the process of turning this around. God, we, as we sang at the very beginning of this service, what you love, we want to love. Where you go, we want to go. What you do, we want to do. So God, help us to be your people even that much more in the hours and in the days ahead. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. You're dismissed.